Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, big bank earnings compare and contrast, the real cost of a patch of asphalt in Houston, Texas, and 18 seconds of your life you might just get back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 19th of April. Glad to have you along, everybody. I don't know about y'all, but there is nothing that gets me going like a good round of big bank earnings reports. That week or so, every quarter, when carefully prepared bundles of financial statements get parsed, and we can see how the country's biggest banks are doing. Yes, I know, a quarter is just a quarter and does not a trend make, but there is some interesting comparing and contrasting to be done this time around. Net income at Goldman Sachs, just for instance, we learned this morning, net income at Goldman tumbled 60% from a year ago, 60%. Same category at JPMorgan Chase, net income also down, but a mere 6%. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the whys behind those numbers.
If you follow the news even a little, the stuff dragging on big banks will sound very familiar. The stock market started the year real ugly. There were concerns about global growth, including fears about China's slowdown. Oil prices were lower, among other headwinds. Gerard Cassidy is head of bank equity research at RBC Capital Markets.
Many people did go to the sidelines, both companies looking to raise capital, as well as individual investors, as well as institutional investors, because of this uncertainty and risk.
Lower activity, for example, less trading or fewer companies going public, means lower fees for banks. Mike Mayo, managing director of CLSA Americas, says, yeah, bank results were kind of lousy this quarter. But when it comes to bank stability, things are looking very good.
That's the flip side of regulation. On the one hand, regulation has depressed the results for the banks. On the other hand, regulation has strengthened the foundation of banks. There's no question that the lower returns at banks is to some degree a consequence of the regulators' desire for banks to de-risk and de-lever.
Even if returns maybe weren't spectacular, the banks were still profitable this quarter, says David Hilder. He's a senior bank analyst at Drexel Hamilton.
It's all a matter of perspective.
And a bright spot was commercial lending,
which I think is a very good sign for the U.S. economy. When U.S. businesses are borrowing money, that means that they're borrowing to build inventories or build plants or hire people.
I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The price of a barrel of crude oil today changed. It moved. That's what oil does. It goes up. It goes down. Traders are still processing the fallout of a failed OPEC meeting this past weekend, the one where the cartel and Russia were going to freeze production. But here's the thing. If everybody keeps on pumping full bore or close to it like they are doing right now, supplies are going to keep on outstripping demand and prices are going to stay low. But when it comes to being able to bear the pain of those low prices, not all petrostates are created equal, you know. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains the oil-producer divide.
What do ISIS, salaries in Moscow, and food lines in Caracas have in common? The oil price bust. It reverberates wide in countries that rely the most on oil sales. Consultant Bob McNally of the Rapidan Group says two countries that pushed hard for a producer freeze are Venezuela, where there are food shortages, and Russia.
Below $40 a barrel, President Putin has to make some very unpleasant decisions, like raising taxes on his oil industry. And if you go into the teens, the Russians need to then think about cutting salaries for soldiers and workers.
You may recall one nail in the Soviet Union coffin was an oil collapse in the late 80s. David Goldwyn runs an international energy advisory, and he considers Iraq highly exposed.
Their choice will be to hollow out even further their ability to fight ISIS, to stop repairing the electrical grid, and to cut the availability of fuel and food for their citizens.
What many petrostates did in the boom was to plan their budgets assuming high prices and high revenue. Nigeria and Angola assumed $80 oil, says Africa investment advisor Aubrey Rubi.
Given that we live in a less than $40 a barrel environment, they are now seeking to close $1 billion or more budget deficits.
Both are now seeking IMF help. Now, if any country can be deemed a winner of these oil hunger games, Saudi Arabia has years of savings stored up, as do Kuwait and the Emirates. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was fine. Nothing spectacular, just fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I don't know how they figured this out, but officials in Harris County, Texas, within which lies the city of Houston, are saying 240 billion gallons of rain have fallen in the greater Houston area the past couple of days. After the devastating Memorial Day floods in Houston last year, a professor who studies these things called that city the number one city in America to be injured and die in a flood. Samuel Brody is that professor's name. He is a professor of marine sciences and planning at Texas A&M University, and we've called him up to see why Houston keeps getting hit so hard. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
What is it with Houston? I mean, they had floods last year. They've had floods a couple of years in a row now, big ones, serious ones, damaging ones, and they're not the only city in this country that's at sea level. So what is it?
They're not. Houston's unique in that it's a low-lying area, barely above sea level. It's originally made up of bayous and soils that don't drain too well, and it's a city that's afflicted by flooding from both the sea, saltwater flooding, and rainfall-based flooding. The problem is not the environmental conditions, but the problem is pavement. The city is growing at a tremendous rate over the last 15 years. We added over 25% more pavement in the area, and with pavement and people and structures and environmentally vulnerable places, that equates to a lot of flood damage.
Can you quantify how much pavement translates into how much damage? I mean, is there like a formula you guys have?
We do. In the Houston area, every square meter of pavement equates to about $4,000 in extra flood damage.
Every square meter. So a square of pavement 3 feet by 3 feet.
Yes.
Costs you $4,000 in flood damage.
Yes, and over the last 11 years, Houston alone has incurred over $3.5 billion in just insured losses to residences and businesses.
Just insured losses, so we don't even really know what's going on off the books.
We don't. The rule of thumb is multiplied by four.
Mayor Turner, the mayor of Houston, said yesterday, a lot of rain is coming in a very short period of time. There is nothing you can do. Is that true?
When we get a lot of rain, homes may get flooded, but I believe that we don't have to accept failure. With smart planning and strategies in place, we can prevent flooding and flood damage. It's all about protection, not about recovery. We know that elevating structures above the 100-year level of inundation is saving, on average, about $1 million per community per year in the United States. Huh. There's no reason we can't do that in Houston.
As a guy who studies this and who, in essence, knows it's coming, what do you think when you see the film of the flooding and the pictures and all of that?
It really breaks my heart, particularly in areas that are chronically flooded over time. So there's a neighborhood in Houston called Meyerland, and thousands of homes got flooded last Memorial Day weekend, and they just got hit yesterday. And it really hits me home because I dedicated my life to this work, and I'm trying to make positive change. And, you know, I've been down, and my wife says, "You don't even know these people." So it doesn't matter. I feel for them, and it makes me want to work harder.
Professor Sam Brody at Texas A&M. Sam, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
The political scene today is all New York, all the time. Primaries there, as you can't help but have heard. The end game, of course, is the delegate count and the conventions at which those delegates will be officially tallied. The Republicans are up first mid-July in Cleveland, Ohio. Missing so far, though, from the convention lineup are some of the regulars, big companies that traditionally sponsor big political gatherings. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer went to Cleveland to ask around.
Even if it's a month from now, we'll get breakfast or lunch or dinner.
David Gilbert is an accomplished networker. I caught up with him in Cleveland's convention center, where he seemed to know everyone.
I'll see you in a bit.
Gilbert is the CEO of the host committee of the Republican National Convention. His committee is responsible for raising $57 million in cash. It's also seeking in-kind donations. He says they still have to raise $8 million in cash. He doesn't know of any corporate donors who've backed out of their commitments, although some are hesitating to support the convention.
They've said they want to see how it plays out. It hasn't been relayed to me that it is a one specific concern about politics or safety or anything like that.
Some strategists say corporations are worried about being associated with protests or controversy if there's an open convention.
Well, I think anyone who does brand management is concerned about where your brand is placed.
Bruce Haynes is president of Purple Strategies, a brand consulting firm in Virginia. He says corporations have been spooked by confrontations at some of Donald Trump's events.
People have looked at some of the Trump rallies. They felt like, wow, is that what's going to happen in Cleveland? Is that something I want to be involved with?
Haynes says corporations will wait longer than they normally would to make a convention contribution, and that could spill over to the Democratic convention, because Haynes says most companies want to appear bipartisan and balanced politically, so concerns about one convention have a chilling effect on the other. Back in Cleveland, David Gilbert insists only a few companies are still dithering about donations.
And you can count on a couple of fingers, people who've said we want a little more time and see how this plays out.
But there are some big names among the holdouts. A Walmart spokesman told me in an email that it hasn't made a decision about its presence or participation. Coke has given $75,000 to the Republican convention, but it's still not clear if it'll make its usual in-kind donations of soft drinks and other beverages. Still, Gilbert and other Cleveland convention boosters are not deterred.
No, I don't think it's going to affect us at all.
Mary Farrell runs a gift shop in Cleveland called Bright Green, a couple streets away from the arena where the convention will be held. She only sells locally made products. She says if there's less Coke available,
it might even give us a better opportunity to promote our own beverages, because we make all sorts of things here. You know, different sodas that are made locally and kombucha tea that's available here in Cleveland made locally.
Farrell runs her shop with her 84-year-old mother, Elizabeth Roshkop Farrell, who's lived in Cleveland all her life and says big companies have come and gone before.
Higbee's, May Company, Halley's, Neiman Marcus, they were here. They've all left.
Cleveland's downtown suffered, but now stores and people are coming back. Roshkop Farrell says the city survived. And now?
Yes, and now Cleveland's starting to recover, but it's going to take time.
Roshkop Farrell says the Republican convention won't turn things around instantly for Cleveland, but her daughter Mary is really hoping for a bump in business. She could be running the store alone, though. Her mother, a lifelong Republican, might protest at the convention if she doesn't like the GOP nominee. In Cleveland, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Yeah, I mean, basically, though, the employers don't trust the bachelor's degree to give them all the soft skills that they want.
It's not the degree, it's how you get it. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 49 points today, about a quarter percent, closed at 18,053. Did the blue chips, the S&P 500 picked up 6 points, 0.3%, 2,100 on the nose, but the NASDAQ down 19 points, 0.4%, 49.40 there. All right, so let's go with tech here, shall we? Intel up slightly before the bell, but then dropped more than 3% after it announced earnings and a restructuring that's going to eliminate 11% of its global workforce. That is 12,000 jobs. Netflix took a huge hit after yesterday's warning that slower growth is coming at home and overseas. Shares peeled off 13%. Yahoo was down about 0.5% during the session, but shares lifted more than 1% after hours when earnings beat expectations low. Expectations, I'm obliged to add here. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The number of the day today is 1818. It's denominated in seconds, and it's the amount of time that a new software update from Visa might save consumers and businesses who use those new chip-enabled credit and debit cards. Because you've been there, right? You stick your new card in the reader says, processing, processing, processing. You stand there, the salesperson stands there, the line behind you builds up, and then finally, you're done. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is on the line to explain what is up with that. Hey, Molly.
Hello there.
So is it just a software update? I mean, what else is going on here?
Apparently, it is just a software update. It'll go out to the terminals. Visa, interestingly, has not said whether it plans to charge merchants for the software update. But you won't need a new card, and that's the most important thing. I think a lot of people haven't even gotten their cards with chips in them. So it's not like you have to wait for a new one to show up.
All right. But riddle me this. Why has this taken so long here to recognize, first of all, that it's a problem, and second of all, to do anything about it? Because in Europe, they've had chip cards forever.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is frankly astonishing that nobody went through that process and said, hey, this takes a little bit too long. Part of the reason that it's a little different here from Europe is that the authentication is happening over the internet. And in Europe, it usually happens locally. That's why the PIN is much more common there. So it's a little bit of it. It just is the technology and the way the tech works. But it is also a huge, as we like to say in the Valley, user interface fail.
Well, it totally is, right? Because you walk into the Rite Aid and you see there's a long line and you're like, I'm not doing that with the chip card thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible for consumers. It doesn't sound like 2 to 15 seconds is a lot of your time, but it is, especially since we're trying to learn a new behavior. Yeah. On top of that, those delays, they can cost millions of dollars for the retailers. I mean, time is money.
Right. Is there, do you suppose, an angle here that Visa and the credit card companies are a little worried about the frictionless payment systems, the Apple Pays and Samsung Pay and all that?
Well, you know, what powers those payment systems is still the Visa or the MasterCard or the credit card that you've put in behind it. So they're going to make money no matter what. But I think they're absolutely concerned that consumers will reject this behavior and maybe they'll decide that they would rather use something else. And right now there isn't an option that doesn't include credit cards for most people. So they'll be okay, but you definitely don't want to roll something out that everybody hates.
A mention here about the rollout. It's not even like all retailers in this country already have the chip reader machine things.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the time that the transaction takes is only one of the barriers to this rollout. Only about 20% of retailers right now have new terminals that are actually turned on. There's another 30% that have them, but there is a long certification process that I think nobody saw coming. And because everybody's trying to do it at once, they're super backed up. So it's taking weeks, even months, to get the terminals certified. So retailers who are on the hook for liability, by the way, if these credit card numbers get stolen, can't get their new terminals up and running. But that leaves, if you did the math with me, a whole 50% of retailers who just are sitting on the fence, just waiting it out.
It's not just me, right? It makes you crazy too, the 15 seconds?
I hate it. Yeah. I hate it. You know what it's made me do a lot more often whenever I can?
Cash.
Apple Pay.
Oh, Apple Pay. Well, there you go. There you go.
Yep.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
It's my pleasure.
We went out today and asked you on social media, is the long wait at the register worth it for the chip card? So far, the answers have been overwhelmingly yes. Clearly, nobody checked with me. You can see them at marketplace.org. If you've spent enough or really any time in a big city, you know traffic can be a drag. A drag on productivity, on the environment, on people's moods, and also on their health. Last month in Mexico City, home to some of the worst traffic in the world, things got so bad the city declared a pollution emergency, the first time in a decade that that had been done. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams landed in Mexico City a couple of weeks after that.
The sound of brakes and snarled traffic introduced me to Mexico City just as people were freaking out about the new rule. In response to the crisis, the government expanded a program to limit emissions. For one day a week and one Saturday a month, most people will have to leave their cars parked.
We are used to have it, but with a lot of exceptions, depending on the type of car and mainly the age of the car.
Alberto Padilla is country manager for BlaBlaCar, an online carpooling service.
But right now, what is changing is that it is becoming mandatory for every type of car and every people in the city, right?
Padilla says he's already seeing a spike in interest as people scramble for options to get around. Private bus driver Manuel Ramirez says the new rule is annoying, but overdue.
Because the first program basically affected people who are from low incomes, because they didn't have the income to buy the much newer cars.
He says the new program is more fair, although some complain Mexico's rich will just buy more cars to skirt the law. In Mexico City, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Kimberly's border reporting is produced for us with support from the International Women's Media Foundation. We're creeping up on another round of high school graduations in a month or so, and then, for millions of 17- and 18-year-olds, either the best or most stressful 4 years of their lives, college. And yes, you go to college for book knowledge and how to function as an adult human being, but according to education writer Jeffrey Salingo, maybe the most valuable skill students need to get a job after college might not be found on campus anymore. His new book on the topic is called There Is Life After College. Jeffrey, thanks for coming on.
It's good to be here.
Okay, wait, there is life after college?
Believe it or not, there is.
It's different now, though, right? That's the name of the game, and that's the thrust of this book.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. You know, when I graduated from college 20 years ago, if you had a bachelor's degree, you were golden. Mm-hmm. You got a job. And today now, a bachelor's degree, while it's still a strong signal of job readiness, there are plenty of underemployed college graduates. So it's much more about how you go to college now than where you go or even if you go in some cases.
All right. So hit me. What does that mean? What is the difference between kids who are prepared and kids who are not once they get out? And I call them kids, but they're really, you know, 21, 22 years old. You say it's how they go to college. What does that mean?
So the biggest difference is that those students who take advantage, particularly of outside the classroom experiences, study abroad, project-based learning, undergraduate research, and the big one, internships. It helps develop those soft skills that employers over and over again say they want, problem solving, working in teams, and the big one, the ability to navigate the ambiguity of the day-to-day work.
Well, you know, it's actually a theme in this book. You talk a lot about resilience and grit, that idea of being able to figure out what to do when things go wrong.
And most students have a hard time doing that. You know, for the most part, education has been directed for them throughout their life. Think about the college classroom of today. It's very task-based, right? Take an exam, finish a paper, attend a club meeting, go to practice. And for the most part, the modern workforce is a mashup of activities, and most students don't know how to address that.
So what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to change that? What is the college of the future?
Well, for one thing, I think that we need to press pause and give some students more time. 400,000 students drop out of college every year, many of them freshmen. And now we have more millennials than any other age group in the United States. We have some college credit and no degree. And that's really worrisome for the future of the country and for the workforce. So I'm a big fan, for example, of giving some students time off after high school, gap years, for example. And when they actually do go to college, they're much more mature and they're much more focused and come out on time and actually spend even less money than they probably would have spent wandering.
You say that depending on how dedicated you want to be once you get out of college, it's not okay to be a camp counselor or a lifeguard, summer after sophomore year, like one of us in this conversation did.
Yes, I mean, this was the big aha moment for me in the book. The more internships you have, and if you scaffold them on top of one another, you're probably going to get a job offer out of them. In fact, most career counselors told me that employers now are coming to campuses not to recruit second semester seniors, but to recruit sophomores and juniors into their internship programs because they want to try out these students before they buy them after graduation.
Oh, man, that's a little harsh, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, though, the employers don't trust the bachelor's degree to have give them all the soft skills that they want. Oof. And we need to rethink what we mean by education after high school, including giving students more time to acquire that education.
This is none of my business, but do you have kids?
Yes.
College-age kids or close?
No, 6 and 4.
All right, well, I got news for you, pal. It's coming down the pike, right? Nobody's immune from this.
No one's immune, and I already see the mistakes I'm making in terms of trying to teach them how to learn from failure. You know, I'm the first guy at the playground when they're coming down that slide, yeah. And I see that they're not gonna land in a good way. Then I'm the first one to catch them.
Yeah, tell me about it. Jeff Zilingo is the author, most recently, of There Is Life After College. Jeff, thanks very much.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
This final note on the way out today, a coda to the news that Treasury Secretary Jack Lew is probably, sort of, kind of, I hope, going to keep Alexander Hamilton on one side of the $10 bill and put an as-yet-unnamed woman on the other side. I digress, though, a little bit. The Wall Street Journal reports today that in his original memo to the president outlining his now thankfully failed plan to get Hamilton off the 10, Lew also proposed doing away with the penny. Amen, brother. That's all I got on that one. We should do a social media poll on the penny. Keep it or, get rid of it. That'd get people going. All right, the Dow up 49 points today, about 0.25%. The S&P 500 picked up 6 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 19 points, 0.4%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I'm telling you, people write every time I talk about the penny. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.